I'd like to assign the lesson for next time now. If you would please note this down, this is due next Friday noon. I would like you to take Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 verses 4, 5, 8, and 9. Those four verses. 4, 5, 8, and 9. I would like to have you compare the King James Version with some modern version. I don't care what one you use, but just state on your paper what version you have used and make a comparison of any difference that impresses you as at all important. Now that's the assignment that is due for next Friday noon, except for those who are taking the course for graduate credit. If you're taking the course for 1 hour of graduate credit, do the same thing except on points of difference between them. Check the Hebrew and give me your opinion of which it fits with or why. Yes? Any difference that seems to you important? Well, if it seems important, say a little about it. Yes. Yes, note the difference and say, if it doesn't affect the thought, say so. If it really is a vital difference, say so. And that's all. It's quite a brief assignment. Except for the graduate students, I would like them to go into it a little more thoroughly and to give me a statement as to whether the Hebrew inclines one direction or the other, where you find a difference. Now, we were looking last time at the section of Isaiah that included chapter 50. And we noticed how in chapter 50, the first three verses really belong with the previous chapter. They are another stanza of the same discussion as in the previous chapter. And you really should start a new chapter with verse 4. And with verse 4, we have statements made in what follows that would be difficult to explain if we had not already in chapter 49 had the servant of the Lord speaking and telling how the Lord was going to use him to raise up the tribes of Jacob and also to bring light to all the nations. And thus, having had the servant of the Lord speaking so recently, it is a viable option to see whether he might be speaking in verses 4 following. And we noticed there that there are terms made, statements made, that or hardly would fit Israel. It wouldn't seem to be Israel saying, "The sovereign Lord has opened my ears and I've not been rebellious, I've not drawn back," because Isaiah has been criticizing them in previous chapters for having been rebellious. And going on, "I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting." Well, that certainly doesn't sound like Israel talking. And it doesn't sound like Isaiah talking. Isaiah may perhaps in the last part of his life have suffered some persecution, but we certainly have no evidence of his having ever voluntarily submitted to humiliation as described here. And so it would seem, and of course it's not God speaking, because the sovereign Lord has given me this. The sovereign Lord has done this, so that it is quite evidently the option remaining is that it is the servant. And we have learned quite a bit about the servant of the Lord in previous chapters. Now, beginning in verse 4, "The sovereign Lord has given me," the NIV says, "an instructed tongue." The King James says, "the tongue of the learned." Now, the trouble with that is that in present-day English, learned suggests a scholar, somebody like that. If you take the word learned in its literal sense, it fits exactly. It's a good translation. But it doesn't quite give the idea of us today. We think of him as possibly having received a doctor's degree and doing great research when they say the tongue of the learned. But the tongue of the one who has been instructed. But it's not the one, because it is definitely a plural form. The King James, in this case, conveys that idea well, because in modern English, we do not use an adjective as a noun, except for a plural. We say between the quick and the dead. We don't mean one person and another person. We mean the plural. In most languages, you can use it for singular or plural. But in modern English, only for plural. And here it is plural. So the translation, an instructed tongue, is not very literal in the NIV. It is the tongue of those who have been instructed. There's perhaps not much difference in the sense there. In Old English, you could use it for singular, as you can today in most languages. And so where we read in Isaiah 11 that he shall smite the wicked, and we read that in Second Thessalonians, then shall that one be revealed, whom that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord will strike with the breath of his lips, and so on. That wicked should be that wicked one. It is singular. But in Old English, you could use the term for singular or plural. So here the Lord has given him a tongue that is like the tongues of those who are instructed. And you remember that people said of Jesus, how does this man know so much, having never been schooled? Well, he knew everything. And he showed a knowledge far beyond what anyone would ever have expected him to have. To know the word that sustains the weary. He wakens me morning by morning, wakens my ear to listen like one being taught. And the gospel show us how Jesus lived in constant communion with his Father. He was constantly in touch with his Father. There is a great stress there in the New Testament on the relationship, which is this particular thing might be said of Isaiah. But the whole context wouldn't fit Isaiah, but it does look forward to Christ very definitely, what he can do, what he will do. The Sovereign Lord has opened my ears, and I've not been rebellious, I've not drawn back. I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out the beard. I did not hide my face from walking and spitting. And the New Testament tells us how Jesus voluntarily suffered. He says, I lay down my life. No man taketh it from me. He said to Pilate, you could do nothing if it was not given to you to do it. He had all power, but he chose not to use it. Because the Sovereign Lord helps me, I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I have set my face like flint. Everybody said, don't go up to Jerusalem. You'll be killed. You'll be injured. We read in the New Testament, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And I know that I will not be put to shame. He who vindicates me is near. Who then will bring charges against me? Let us face each other. Who is my confuser, my accuser? Let him confront me. It is the Sovereign Lord who helps me. Who is he that will condemn me? They will all wear out like a garment. The moths will eat them up. Very interesting there how he compares his endless life to the life of the people who were attacking him and persecuting him. They will wear out. The moths will eat them up, but he will live forever. And then in verses 10 and 11, the servant addresses the people in general. He says, who among you fears the Lord and obeys the word of his servant? Let him who walks in the dark, who has no light, trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God. Describing the life of the Christian who does not know what is ahead. He does not know what God's plan is for him. He is to some extent walking in the dark. He should use all the light he can get. But still we are walking in the dark. We don't know what's ahead for any one of us. But we can trust in the name of the Lord and know that if we are truly his, we can rely on him. But in verse 11, he turns back to those who do not trust in the Lord, who do not look to the Word of God for their wisdom. He says, but now all you who light fires and provide yourselves with flaming torches, you who think that by human wisdom you are going to find the answer to your problems, you who think you can direct your life in the way you should, you who think you can figure everything out on a human basis, you light fires and provide yourselves with flaming torches. He says, go walk in the light of your fires and of the torches you've set ablaze. This is what you'll receive from my hand. You will lie down in torment. Of course, God wants us to use all the light we can get. He gave us our brains to use, but we don't know what's ahead, and we can put all that we can learn by purely human means in a secondary place in relation to the Word of God, which is the primary source of our knowledge. And so he said, those who trust only in their own wisdom, he says, they will lie down in torment. And then in chapter 51, we start a long poem of reassurance. And this long poem of reassurance is to a large extent addressed to Israel, thought of as inevitably going into exile, and written in such a way as to comfort the Israelites in exile. But at the same time, recognizing some of the development of thought in the previous chapters, that after all, the reason they're going into exile is because of their sin. And if God delivers them from exile and does not deal with the sin question, there will be other exiles, inevitably. The sin question is the more vital. But in this passage, the question of sin is only touched on a little. There is hardly any rebuke in this section. It is more assurance. Assurance that they can trust in the Lord, that if they put their faith in Him, they can know He's going to fulfill His promise. He's going to bring them back from exile. And the suggestion, not strongly brought out in this section, that He is also going to deal with the sin question, which is, after all, the cause of the exile, as He's been gradually developing the thought to us from chapter 41 on. Chapter 40, you remember, was a prelude to the whole section, touching upon the general themes that we find throughout the section. We have, to some extent, a reminiscence in this section of chapter 40, as we again touch on certain of its main ideas. And so he says, look to me, you who pursue righteousness and seek to the Lord. Look to the rock where you were cut and the quarry from which you were hewn. Look to Abraham your father and to Sarah who gave you birth. When I called him, he was but one. I blessed him and made him many. God has given great blessings to Abraham. Look back at what he's done. Now don't despair and say God won't do anything to you. You can trust in him. And he continues through this section with reasons for assurance for the people to trust in him. But in chapters 4 and 5, he goes way beyond the immediate situation and promises what he's going to do in the future. Verse 4, listen to me, the law will go out from me, my justice will become a light to the nations. My righteousness draws near speedily, my salvation is on the way, and my arm will bring justice to the nations. The islands will look to me and wait and hope for my arm. Lift up your eyes to the heavens. Look at the earth beneath. The heavens will vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment, and its inhabitants die like flies. But my salvation will last forever. My righteousness will never fail. And so he continues with these assurances of God's continuing blessing. In verse 9, he says, awake, awake, close yourself with strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the days gone by, as in generation of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces? Well, the nations around Israel observed human sacrifice, but God never commanded it to Israel. And so why should somebody say that it was the arm of the Lord that cut Rahab to pieces? Well, here we have a strange thing, that the very same word which was the name of Rahab, the woman who was blessed for helping the Israelites as they went into the land, that exact same sound is a common term occasionally used in the scripture with the idea of a monster and specialized for Egypt because of the way that Egypt held the Israelites in bondage and the way that God delivered them up. So there are several instances, there are two or three instances out of the very few times this word occurs this way. There are two or three instances where it definitely means a monster, and two or three where it definitely means Egypt, and one or two where we're not quite sure which is meant. But here he refers undoubtedly to Egypt, who pierced that monster through, because the next verse, was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over? Here he's looking back to the deliverance through the Red Sea as he delivered them from Egypt. He says the arm of the Lord has done this. We can expect him still to give us deliverance. We can trust him even as he delivered them. And then in verses 12 to 16, in verse 15, we have perhaps the last great stress on the idea of God's creative power in this section. You remember how that's been stressed in chapter after chapter previously. Between Isaiah 40 and here, we have more stress on God's creative power than in any other section of the Bible except the book of Joel. It's here there is this tremendous stress on God's creative power, because it is dealing with his power to rescue the people from exile and his power to deal with the cause of the exile, to deal with the problem of sin. And so there is here the last great stress on this, verse 13 following, that you forget you, the Lord your maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth. Astronomers today are agreed that the heavens were stretched out. 50 years ago, there were many of them who doubted it, perhaps even 20 years ago. They thought, many, that the heavens had always been exactly as they are now. Great universe of stars and galaxies, always there, never started. But today, all astronomers agree, I believe, that all the universe was at one time a small ball of matter. That this small ball of material had a tremendous explosion, and that this, after this tremendous explosion, that all the stars and galaxies have been moving rapidly away from one another, and nobody knows what caused them to do it. Some astronomers have tried to say that there is the universe has always been here, but it's just been going in and out. That pretty soon all this matter will stop going out, and gravity will take over, and it'll all come together, and we'll again have a great ball of matter, or a small ball, with all the matter of the universe together, and again it will explode. But the attempt has been made to prove that, and the evidence that is at present available leads most astronomers to say there is no reason to think that the universe is going to collapse. And if there's no reason to think it's going to collapse, there's no reason to think it ever did collapse. And so all the evidence today that science has points to the whole universe having started at one time and then gone out with a tremendous motion in all directions, and exactly fits what is said here. The Lord your maker who stretched out the heavens. Not who simply made them as they are, but who stretched them out. And it's an interesting thing that this phrase, stretched out the heavens, is used a few times of the Lord in the prophetical books. The Lord who stretched out the heavens. But there are a few times when, instead of using the perfect tense, as used here, it uses the participle, who is stretching out the heavens. And why should such an idea have ever occurred, that he was stretching out the heavens, or that he is stretching out. Not that he simply did something once, but that he is doing it, that it's a continuous action. Well, anybody up until 50 years ago would have said, of course, that's just a form of expression. You sometimes say stretched out, you sometimes say is stretching out. But we know now, have known for the last 50 years, I don't know whether we should use the word know for anything that we do not have on the evidence of the Scripture. But I will say that as far as all scientists believe today, they all believe that the whole universe is being stretched out. That it is all parts of the universe are moving away from all other parts at a rapid rate as a result of a discovery made in the first decade of this century, which all astronomers now agree shows that that is the situation. And if that is true, we have here a very interesting, in this use of this participle, suggestion of the idea. Not that somebody could have constructed that science from the Bible, but there is a suggestion there, which when we make the discovery, we find that what the Scripture says fits exactly with it. Do you have a question, Mr. Martin?
I was wondering if you could give us an example of one place where the universe was used.
No, I don't think the imperfect is ever used. The perfect is used in a few cases like here, but who stretched out. That is, it'd be the imperfect of all conversive, of course, the equivalent of the perfect. But the participle is used in five or six cases. I don't have the references with me. But one can very easily find them by looking up the word nata in the Hebrew dictionary and seeing the references to its use as a participle, or by looking in almost any concordance. It's quite easy to find them. I've never heard that pointed out by anybody else, but I was struck by the difference in the form used, and then when I came across the knowledge that this is so generally believed by astronomers, I believe by all astronomers today, it struck me as very interesting that there was already a suggestion of it here in the Scripture. So he refers to the Lord's great power that here he refers to the beginning of it. Now specific emphasis on the continuation, that he stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth. That it is not a natural process simply, but that it is what the Lord God has done. And so he continues with the words of assurance to Israel, with emphasis on the way that he is to deal with their problems, but not only that he is going to deal with the cause of these problems. And so here there is a considerable amount of mention of their suffering, of their sad condition. There's no rebuke really through here. In earlier chapters, we've had fairly strong rebuke, although nothing like other parts of the prophetic books. From chapters 40 on here, the theme is mostly comfort, with just an occasional reference to the fact that the cause of all their problems is their sin. But it's mostly comfort, because they are thought of as those who primarily need comfort here, rather than rebuke, but an occasional slight rebuke to bring to their attention the cause of all the suffering that they are going through. And chapter 52 is a clear continuation of what precedes. We've had these various sections starting, awake, awake, and then going on, and chapter 52 the same way, awake, awake, O Zion, clothe yourself with strength, put on your garments of splendor. And he continues with his promises of blessing to the people, of deliverance from the exile. And in verse 7 following, we have a very strong echo of chapter 40. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news. You remember in chapter 40, O Jerusalem, get you up into the high mountains. O Zion, bring assurance of blessing to God's people. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace. who say to Zion, your God reigns. This fits with deliverance from exile. It also fits with deliverance from the problem of sin. Both are being dealt with throughout this section. Listen, Europe. Watchmen lift up their voice. Together they shout for joy when the Lord returns to Zion. They will see it with their own eyes. And verse 11 is very definitely getting back to the idea of the deliverance from exile. Depart, depart, go out from thence, touch no unclean thing. Come out from it and be pure, you who carry the vessels of the Lord. You remember that when Cyrus gave the decree permitting the people to go back from exile, he ordered that the vessels of the temple, which had been taken by Nebuchadnezzar when Jerusalem was conquered, which were in Babylon, be given to them to take back to the new temple to be built in Jerusalem. And so you who carry the vessels of the Lord, but you will not leave in haste or in flight, for the Lord will go before you, the God of Israel will be your rear guard. You think of the Israelites in captive, far away from their homeland, and they might conceivably manage in a time of a revolution or difficulty in the Babylonian government to escape and to flee back in danger. But that's not what God says is going to happen. You will not go by flight. You won't have to leave in haste. God is sending Cyrus, who will issue a decree permitting the Israelites to go back, all of those who desire to, and giving them help to go back and rebuild Jerusalem, the city, and to again set up the temple. Depart, depart, go out from there, touch no unclean thing. Come out from it and be pure, you who carry the vessels of the Lord. But you will not leave in haste or go in flight, for the Lord will go before you. The God of Israel will be your rear guard. And this is where there should be a new chapter division. And it is truly unfortunate that the English archbishop in the 12th century A.D., when he rode on his horse going on his pastoral calls and made his chapter divisions in the Latin Bible, which were later taken over into the Hebrew, that instead of putting the chapter division here where it belongs, he put it three verses later. And it breaks up the thought. And the result is that you will find commentaries discussing Isaiah 53, who will begin, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Who is talking, they say? Who is talking? Why, it's evidently the great voice of the succession of the prophets. Who has believed our message? The King James says, who has believed our report? Personally, I do not think that either report or message is a good translation here. I think that the American Revised Version is a much better translation. I'm not speaking the Revised Standard, I'm speaking of the version that came out in 19:1, which is, who has believed what we have heard? Because the form here is definitely a passive participle. Who has believed what we have heard? Now, what we've heard is a message, of course. But if it was talking about who's believed what we have given out, you would expect it to use a different form than the passive participle. Of course, it does carry over the idea that not everybody is going to believe it. And so the New Testament very properly uses it in that sense, that not everybody is going to believe the message. It quotes it. And that is a factor in it, but it's not the primary thought of the verse in the Hebrew. The verse is saying, who has believed what we have heard? And so all this discussion and commentaries would be quite needless, quite unnecessary, if they had only looked at the fact that the chapter begins three verses earlier. That is, this theme, this subject begins three verses earlier, and there should not be a break at this place where the break is made. I think we lose a great deal of the value of Isaiah 53 when we omit its first three verses. I've known many people who have memorized the whole of Isaiah 53. I've never met anyone who has memorized from Isaiah 52:13 on through 53. And I don't think you really get the sense of Isaiah 53. That is, you get a lot out of it. There's a tremendous truth there. The picture of how God is going to deal with sin. The picture of how the servant of the Lord is going to do his great work in this chapter. But you don't really get the proper introduction to it or the proper understanding of it when you leave out the previous three verses that are so important to it. And so a chapter should begin with verse 13, where he has finished his long poem of reassurance, and he begins again with the theme of the servant of the Lord, a theme that we have seen at several instances between chapter 41 and here, where the Lord has introduced it, presented the theme of the servant of the Lord, who is Israel is God's servant, because God brought Israel into the world in order that a certain work be done. Not all of Israel can do this work. Many of them, some of them are definitely hostile to God. They certainly can't be part of the servant. It must be a part of Israel. We have gradually seen as we have looked at these passages that God has made it clear that the servant who does this, while it is Israel, Israel has the responsibility that the work be done. Yet the servant who is to do the work, who is a part of Israel, who can represent Israel, who can do the work for Israel as well as for the rest of the world, is an individual. And so now we find out how this servant is going to do the work. This is the great climax of the book of Isaiah. It is one of the great climaxes of the Old Testament. It's chapter 53, beginning with 52, verse 13. And so it begins with a line that is impossible to translate exactly into English. We notice it begins, "See, my servant will act wisely," in the NIV. But there is there a footnote which says, "or will prosper." And here we have a Hebrew word which has a specific meaning for which I know of no English word. It means that he will do what is effective, and that what he will do will be successful. And so the translation, "he will act wisely," is entirely true, and the translation, "he will prosper," is, well, rightly understood, entirely true. But it does not mean to prosper simply through chance or good fortune or because things turn out your way. It means to do that which accomplishes the results desired. So really, to act wisely and as a consequence succeed in what he is undertaking is what this Hebrew word means. You find even between two languages as similar to each other as English and German are, that it is extremely difficult to make a good translation because the words don't exactly mesh. An English word will have certain meanings in it that a particular German word won't have. And the German word will have certain meanings that the English word won't have. And if you translate just word for word, it often doesn't get the sense across. And if that's true between English and German, how much more with a language so much different from ours as Hebrew is. But we can find out by studying the way the word is used in context exactly what it means. And that is why I believe that the most useful thing for study of the Bible is Young's Analytical Concordance. I don't believe that there's any commentary that is worth half as much to the man who wants to learn what the Bible means as Young's Analytical Concordance is. Because in that, you find every way that a particular Hebrew or Greek word is translated. And then you look under the English word and they put together there the words in which that word occurs with that translation. So it may take you a little time to find the different cases. And sometimes you'll find a Hebrew word which is translated 10 times one way in English and 200 times another. And when you do, you want to see whether they've made a proper translation in the 10 times in English, or whether perhaps that gives you an idea of a certain phase of the meaning that you wouldn't immediately have gotten from the other. Because the only way to tell in any language what a word means is by context. It was thought widely 100 years ago that by etymology you could tell what a word means. And that doesn't tell you what a word means. Etymology gives you suggestions as to what it might mean. You take the old Germanic word from which the German Knecht and the English Knight are derived. And Knecht in German is a servant. And Knight in English is a mark of respect. But the word as used originally, the one was sort of in between. The German, the Knecht, is the one the king looked down at. And it has come to be further down, so that today in German it simply means a servant. But in English, the knight was the man who the king looked down at, but who the bulk of the people saw riding out around on the big horse with armor around him, and they looked up to him. And so we have two words derived from the same original, which have, you might say, opposite meanings. But we can see how they developed from the same one original meaning. And sometimes when a word's developed like that, you will have two very different meanings in English. And you can trace back and see how they came from one original root. Well, in other cases, as in Rahab, which I mentioned a few minutes ago in Hebrew, it's the identical word, but Rahab meaning Egypt and Rahab meaning the woman who helped the spies are entirely different. Just like the English word light. I can hold this up and hold up a little black book and I can say this is much lighter than that. And on the other hand, I can hold up a big white book here and a little black book here and say that's much lighter than this. Because our word light can mean nearer to white or it can mean less heavy. Two utterly different meanings, but they're included in that sense of our English word light. They're utterly different. They're not derived from each other. They were originally different words. And so this word, he will act wisely. He will act in such a way as to accomplish his purpose. And then we have his exaltation. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. The servant is going to be highly exalted. That's a tremendous thing to say. He's highly exalted, but, and we've got that in Isaiah 42, we've got it earlier, but we've also got his humiliation in chapter 40, and to some extent in chapter 50, and to some extent in chapter 49. And our very next verse here is humiliated. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. His exaltation immediately followed by his humiliation, a strange combination, which never would have occurred to a man simply making something up, but which God revealed to Isaiah in giving a prediction, a tremendous prediction of the work of Christ. He's going to be greatly exalted, he's going to succeed in what he undertakes, but he is going to undergo great humiliation. Well, now I'm glad that the NIV says, just as there were many who were appalled at him. The word is often translated in such a way as to convey the idea, many who were surprised at him. But the Hebrew word does not mean surprised. It is more like shocked. Appalled is a very good way of rendering it into English. The other gives quite a false idea. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, the NIV says. And then it has a footnote which says Hebrew you after the him. Well, what are we trying to do in a translation? Are we trying to tell you what the translators think, or are we trying to show you what the Hebrew says? There's no other source I know of for it except the Hebrew, except in those very few cases where a mistake has come in copying the Hebrew, and the Greek Septuagint, the very early translation, preserved the correct meaning. There are a few such cases, but not a great many. Ordinarily, the Hebrew text can be depended upon. And so here, it simply says Hebrew you. Well, if it's the Hebrew you, let's keep the you. Just as many were appalled at you. Well, who's the you? Well, all through the chapter before, we've been talking to Israel. Awake, awake, O Zion. Put on your garments of splendor. O capital daughter of, captive daughter of Zion, you were sold for nothing. Without money, you'll be redeemed. The beginning of chapter 42. We've been talking to Israel before. Now, it is a very good guess that when he says you here, he is talking to Israel, especially since he's been talking of the servant in the third person. And so, another thing that the NIV translators here did not bring out in the translation, neither does the King James. Verse 14 in the Hebrew begins, just as is a good translation. But the next part here, his appearance was so disfigured. The so is the beginning of the phrase in the Hebrew. The same word it is, came, which can mean just as, like this, or so. Like this, you've been appalled. Like this, he's going to be humiliated. It is a definite comparison or a showing of result. It is a close relationship. And we have three statements given, all of which begin with this came. Just as many were appalled at you. Many people may have said, look at Israel, a great nation with great power there. The kingdom of David and Solomon. Look at the long history of Israel. And now you can hardly take Israel as a nation. It is a part of the Babylonian Empire. The people are off there in exile, in suffering, in humiliation. It doesn't seem like a nation anymore. Just as many were appalled at you, so his appearance is disfigured, beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. There is a comparison to Israel. Yes, Mr. Horry? Oh, yes. That would be just what I've been just saying. That they there are recognizing that the you is referring to Israel. Just as many were appalled at you, my people. There's no my people expressed. But the you is all through the chapter before. And the servant is here spoken of in the third person. And so it is the natural interpretation that it is his people he's speaking of. So they added that to the Hebrew in order to show what they thought the you meant, which is, I think, much better than changing it to him, like most modern translations do. Just as Israel seemed not to be a nation, just not seem to have its figure at all of what it was, so his appearance is disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. And then the next line, which should be the end of the verse. The verse should end with one more line. So, again, so marred was he, so shall he sprinkle many nations. And there should be a paragraph break at the end of that line. Just as many were astonished at you, were appalled at you, so is he to seem hardly human for what he suffered. With the scourging, with the crown of thorns, with the terrible suffering of the crucifixion, he will hardly seem human. Such is what he's going to go through. His humiliation compared to the sufferings of Israel in exile. So we have his exaltation, then we have his humiliation, and then we have his accomplishment. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Now the translators of the Greek of the Greek Septuagint didn't get any sense of that. So shall he sprinkle many nations. And so we have a footnote here that says Hebrew, semicolon, Septuagint, so will many nations marvel at him. So they'll marvel at him. But that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says, so shall he sprinkle many nations. The RSV, if I recall correctly, says, so shall he startle many nations. And they have a footnote which says, Hebrew obscure. Well, this word occurs about 22 times in the Old Testament, this Hebrew word. And in about 20 of them, the RSV translates it sprinkle. And in one of them, they translate it spatter. And then in this one, they say Hebrew obscure. And of course, the reason is because the translators of the RSV, just like the translators of the Septuagint, could not get any sense out of saying, so shall he sprinkle many nations. But the word is the word that is commonly used many, many times in the Pentateuch to express the sprinkling with blood of the instruments in the temple in order to purify them. It is the common word for the sacrifices and the purification in the temple. It is a word whose meaning is perfectly plain that way. The only time I think of when it doesn't mean that is when they threw Jezebel out of the window and she was broken by the, when she hit and her blood spattered against the wall. The word definitely means socially sprinkled, but they couldn't get any sense out of it. I can't blame the translators of the Septuagint for not getting any sense out of it. These Jews in those days, they did not understand what it meant. And if they just translated what was there, instead of making a guess and saying, so shall many nations startle, many nations marvel at him, it would have been much better. But Peter knew. Peter knew what it meant. And so let's look at what Peter said. We look at 1 Peter. And we read there in 1 Peter 1, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Well, now how would you express many nations better than that? Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Now what about these many nations? He says, who have been chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father by the sanctifying work of the Spirit for obedience to Jesus Christ and sprinkling by his blood. So Peter says, I know what it means that he shall sprinkle many nations. That is what Jesus Christ has done by bearing their sins on the cross and making it possible to purify them from their sin and making this available not just to the Jews, but to many nations. And that should be the end of a paragraph, and you should start a new part of this Isaiah 53 with the second line of verse 15. But we'll have to leave that until next week. Yes. The three statements that begin with so is so, or so can also be just as, you see. Like this, like that. Just as many. So was his appearance, so transfigured was his, so marred was his appearance, and so shall he sprinkle many nations. Well, I announced the assignment at the beginning of class. Any of you who came late, please get it from somebody else. Yes? He compares the humiliation of Christ to the sufferings of Israel. Yes. He says, just as you seem not to be a person, so will he not. You seem not to be a nation, so will he seem not to be a person.
Okay, so is that the suffering of Israel, that was going back to suffering from captivity, or just in Genesis?
You better speak to me privately. I can't hear you from here with everybody going out. Yes.
The sufferings of Israel, was that what we've been talking about, that there's sufferings in captivity?
Yes, but the particular figure, it says, it uses the Hebrew min, which means away from. It can be more than. but also can be away from it. And it means they did not seem to be a nation. They were scattered among the Babylonians. They seem not to be a nation. He so suffers that he hardly seems human. He's so marred and disfigured
by
the street.
Yeah, they hardly seem a nation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that second part where it says, kings shall shut their mouths at him.
Yeah, that starts a new section.
Oh, that starts
a new paragraph, not a new section, because the section includes all of 53 in these three verses.
Right.
But a new paragraph. It should start a verse.
In the Hebrew text, it starts a new paragraph?
No, in the font.
In the font.
Yeah. Yes, how are you?
Fine. I think you were saying about that section 51:13, the last section on the creative power of God, where it says he stretched out the heavens.
Yeah.
You were saying there that the perfect tense is used. Is that right? Instead of the participle?
I don't remember about this particular place. But I would guess from the translation here that it was here the perfect. I know that the word is used. The term, stretch out the heavens, is used in various prophetical books and altogether about six or eight times. And two or three of them are perfect, and the rest are participles. But I didn't look up to see which
I
it
think
was
it's
here.
A participle there.
Here, really?
Yeah, here.
Good.
Here's verse.
Yes.
Verse 13, and there's no text.
Yeah, that is a participle here. That's very interesting. Yeah. This is one of those that is a participle. Thank you for calling my attention to that. Appreciate that. People not here today. Did you listen who wasn't here? Did you listen who was not here today? What did you say? Mr. Korak.
Yes. Well, he came in about 20 minutes late and then he left, so I don't think he got the assignment. He went right out right away.
Maybe we better put a note on the box. We can put a note. You came too late for the assignment. The assignment was given at the beginning of the hour. Please ask someone else what it is. Maybe we can put a note.
Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned that. What'd you say? You have got, yes. Yes. That's good. But there were quite a few missing, weren't there?
Yes. I wonder why. I thought it might be that there was some
take your coat off again. So warm. Second Chronicles 7:14. That wouldn't be Solomon's dedication of the temple, would it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The question is,
how
are we to see the physical judgments spoken of in verse 13 and then again at the end of 14 about the drought and the plagues and the locusts and the pestilence.
How
can we see or apply that to life today, or should we?
Well, I would say that the Lord may send them as a punishment, or he may send them in order to teach us certain lessons. It may be good for us to have it. But I recall the story about Finney when he was president of Oberlin College. They had a great drought there in Ohio. And for weeks it didn't rain, and everything was beginning to dry up. And so they asked him to hold a prayer meeting for rain. And they assembled in the church, and they were all there ready for the prayer meeting. And President Finney was not yet there. And they looked out and wondered if he's been delayed by something. Then they looked out and they saw him coming down the street carrying a big umbrella. And they all began to laugh. And they said, well, it hasn't rained here for weeks. They said, the skies are absolutely blue. There's not a sign of rain. They said, what a silly thing for him to come carrying an umbrella. They said, what are you carrying an umbrella for? Well, he says, we're going to pray for rain, he says. Well, don't you think the Lord is going to answer our prayer? And they had a big prayer meeting. And when it ended, the rain was pouring down, and he was the only person who had an umbrella. Doesn't say the Lord will always answer prayers like that. Uh-huh. But it does say that if we are truly doing His will and seeking His will and praying as we should, we can know that He will either give us relief or He has a reason for not doing it. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't try to spiritualize those, but seeing that those were judgments.
Judgments, any kind of judgment, yeah. But they may not be judgments.
We also
calamity.
Have
calamity. Mm-hmm.
Could I point to things that are going wrong in Christian,
yes,
Christian people today? Is that judgment in the same sense?
There's much. There's much that is.
Because I want to be able to apply. That's in the passage I'm supposed to preach on. I'm trying,
yeah,
trying,
yeah,
to apply it.
I would apply it to the nation, and I would apply it to the churches. That if they will, that we can't expect the Lord's blessing if we don't turn to Him and turn to Him with our whole heart. And that if we do, you just can't tell what the Lord may choose to do.
Okay. But there are many promises and judgments in the Old Testament having to do with the physical land of Israel.
Well, I think this refers in the first place to them, but it goes on, it refers to all His people of all times.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay. And how about the phrase, if you seek my face?
Yeah, that means if you truly worship Him, you truly bow before Him in adoring worship and seek to have proper relation to Him.
Because,
yeah,
the Lord wouldn't have a face.
No, it's figurative term. Yeah. It's a figurative term. Of course the Lord wouldn't have a face. But it's perfectly clear what it means, I think.
I know it's figurative. I just wondered, yeah, wondering what the, yeah, figure meant.
Yeah, the figure means you seek. If we, the thing that, that where our personality shows most is in our face. And so the figure is used for what? For an intimate relationship with God. Mm-hmm. And, of course, to seek His face, it suggests the idea of worship, like the article I had in the last biblical bulletin, dealing with what true worship is. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's still going.